Interesting Questions from Readers, May 27, 2025. Answered by Bart D. Ehrman. Read by John Paul Middlesworth. Here are some particularly sticky questions I've gotten recently, with expanded answers to share with all of you. Question. Bart, what should we understand by exousia in 1 Corinthians 11:10? Response. Ah, right. A woman is to have an authority, exousia, on her head. It's a confusing verse in a confusing passage. The verse, quote, "For this reason a woman ought to have authority over her head because of the angels," unquote. It's sometimes translated veil, although it clearly does not mean veil per se. But in the context, Paul is talking about why women should wear head coverings in church, and so, in some sense, apparently the veil is seen as an exousia, or authority. His opening explanation is that since God is the head of Christ, and Christ is the head of a man, then the man is the head of a woman. Does head here not refer to the thing sitting on your shoulders, but something like chief authority, as in the head of the department? Exousia itself means something like power, control, or authority. Usually the last, I suppose, but authority can be an abstract authority. I have authority to do this. Or some person slash entity that wields that abstraction. I got in trouble with the authorities. In the 1 Corinthians context, it appears to mean something like symbol of authority. The veil women wear, but men don't, show they are under the man's authority, I guess. The matter is complicated by the even more famous problem of how the sentence ends. Paul explains that the woman needs an authority on her head, quote, "because of the angels," unquote. What? There are two main lines of interpretation depending on which angels he has in mind. One is that he means wicked angels, as in Genesis 6, who need to be averted from seducing the woman by some contrary power slash authority, or her beauty needs to be hidden from them by a veil. Or the good angels, used by God to treat and structure the world and its hierarchies. So the veil shows she is under the authority of her husband, as ordained by God. As you can imagine, there are lots of debates and almost no certainties on this one. My sense of the entire passage is that Paul's trying out every argument he can come up with, hoping one of them works, throwing spaghetti on the wall to see what sticks. That's especially clear to me because of the argument from nature, that it is shameful for a man to have long hair, but long hair is glorious for a woman. And what does that show? That God wants the woman's head covered. I have to say, when I was growing up in the 60s, long hair among my guy friends was certainly not considered shameful. For what it's worth, I need to point out that one of the standard explanations of the passage, that Paul does not want women to be without veils because they will then appear to be prostitutes, and that would give the church a bad reputation, is related to roughly nothing he actually says. It's a clever and common explanation, but not one that he uses, and I should think he would have no problem saying if it was what he was thinking. Question. I was in a discussion with someone about the key 1 Corinthians 15, 3-7 tradition. He told me that in P46, we don't actually have the appearance to the 12 or the 500 at once. See below. Should this be of substantial concern? The last line on that same page contains the first five words of 1 Corinthians 15:5, quote, "and that he appeared to Cephas, then ... unquote. The end of that line is frayed away, as are the lines above, but there should have been more words, not now visible, as we discussed earlier. There are missing words at the ends of each of the preceding lines as well. The first line on the next page, which is the back of the same sheet of papyrus, P111, contains the last six words of 1 Corinthians 15:6, starting with menoisin, thus, quote, "remain alive until now, some having fallen asleep," unquote. Response. P46 is one of the NT papyri found among the Chester Beatty papyri, announced in 1931 and published by F. Kenyon in a series of volumes. It is our oldest surviving chunk of text from the Pauline epistles. One side of the bottoms of most pages are missing, worn out, with most pages missing portions of 2 to 3 lines. There are different numbers of lines on each page, 26 or more. To determine whether a verse would be missing, papyrologists determine what could be fit within lines of writing that are not preserved that are missing. For example, if half a page is missing, or if only a few lines of the page at the top or bottom. In the case of P46, since the bottom of the page is missing the words that follow from 15.5, but the top of the next page continues in mid-15.6, it seems almost certain that Paul's references to Jesus' appearance to the 12 and the 500 were originally there. I don't know of any dispute about this among papyrologists, but maybe someone can correct me. Question: if Matthew and Luke used Mark and didn't know each other, why do they agree about how often the cock crowed? Response: this is one of the minor agreements, where Matthew and Luke have a detail in common that is different from or not in Mark. Why would they have these agreements if they were completely independent of one another? Don't they show that Matthew probably was known to Luke? I think these agreements are very important and need to be studied carefully, but I don't think in themselves they are strong evidence that Matthew was one of Luke's sources. They tend, as I've indicated, to be small, even if important, details, and there are numerous ways to account for them. A. We don't know what form of text was available to Matthew and Luke, and don't know if it was exactly like ours. That is, they both may have had a form of Mark that was different from ours. B. Harmonization of manuscripts was one of the most frequent scribal changes in the Gospels. That is, where a copyist changes one of the Gospels to make it say exactly what another one of them says. It's possible that before our surviving manuscript of one or the other of the Gospels were made, a copyist harmonized either Matthew or Luke, changed the text in light of the other, and this change was incorporated widely among the manuscripts, including those that now happen to survive. C. It may simply be an accidental agreement that they both changed Mark in the same way. This is especially a strong possibility if, one, the change is a small detail, and two, the change would make sense to more than one person. In this case, Mark's account is a bit unnecessarily odd. Why have the cock crow twice before Peter denies Jesus three times? Mark may have had a good reason, but it's not at all obvious. Why not just have the cock crow? If they were both puzzled by it, as I am, they may have independently made a simple alteration. And there are other explanations. The main point to remember, though, is that the synoptic problem is not solved by small detailed agreements like these scattered in one place or another, but by a comprehensive view of the evidence across large swaths of texts. Thinking that Luke copied Matthew creates more problems than it solves, as I have tried to explain in earlier posts.